It's another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies. We're talking about the new Woody Allen movie, Cafe Society. We're talking about the new Star Trek movie. We're going to be talking about the Miles Davis biopic that just came out on DVD and on demand, and a movie called The Dark Horse, which also came out on demand and on DVD. And we're going to talk about some food-themed movies and an event that's happening out in the Hamptons this week. All that on Sitting Around Talking Movies. I'm joined, as always, by Bill Brigoli.
Now I'm salivating.
Bill McCuddy.
I'm sitting around.
And sitting around with us today, our guest who's been with us before, from WBAI, Mike Sargent. All right, let's start out talking about Cafe Society. Okay, so what is this, like the 46th, 48th Woody Allen movie? What is this? I don't know, this guy does a movie a year.
Who's keeping count? I mean, I have no idea. It's a good question, but I know he's gone right into production on his next one. This guy's like the Energizer Bunny.
One a year.
And I also am pleased to report that on a per-screen basis, this is one of his biggest hits ever. So I don't know if it's going to beat Midnight in Paris, but I think it's going to make a lot of money.
Well, this is about takes place in the 1930s, and Jesse Eisenberg plays a young Jewish man who heads out to Hollywood. He lives in the Bronx.
So there's a young Jewish guy in this one?
Well, he's kind of channeling Woody Allen. And
Kinda.
He's from the Bronx, and he heads to Hollywood, and he wants a job, which he gets, with his uncle, played by Steve Carell, who's a super agent to all the big stars in the 30s in Hollywood. And he becomes smitten and romantically involved with his uncle's secretary, played by Kristen Stewart. But unbeknownst to him, Steve Carell, his uncle, is having an extramarital affair with Kristen Stewart. And the action takes place both in Hollywood, and then ultimately Eisenberg winds up back in New York, where he runs a swanky nightclub that is kind of owned by, that is owned actually by his gangster brother, and that is what it is about.
Played by Corey Stoll.
And
Corey Stoll's great.
He is great.
I liked
great.
Him with hair.
I think the movie's really entertaining, and it has some several good scenes, and it's sweet in spots, and it's comedic in other spots, and I think Carell's good, and I think Kristen Stewart is revelatory. I mean, she's terrific in this. I mean, you know, if you only know her from, like, the Twilight movies, I mean, but she's done some other movies, too. She's really good, and, you know, Blake Lively has a cameo in it. She's in it for, like, 5 minutes. She's not bad.
In the words of the late Bob Hope, who I quote often on this show,
there you go.
Blake Lively. Man, oh, man.
How'd you like the movie?
Sorry, Mrs. McCuddy.
How'd
this is
like
my
movie,
job.
Bill?
I liked it. I actually want your opinion. Is this the most Jewish movie he's ever made?
Well, they talk Yiddish in the movie, and they don't translate it.
In some ways, he talks about the religion more than Jewish eccentricities.
Well, he's got
a Passover Seder.
Yeah, but
there's a lot of Yiddish
expressions. There's always.
No, I don't think it's
everything you also
Jewish.
Want to know about sex has Yiddish in it with the little tailor. We'll take it in. We'll
then,
let it out.
Annie
sleeper
Hall has the scene when. Can you, you know...
Just the scene. But this, the brother at one point has to change religions because Jews don't have an afterlife. I didn't know you guys don't have an afterlife. What's going to happen to you, Neil?
Is that true? I think your afterlife is right here in New York One. I think you may have passed away years ago, and we're looking at it now. You look good.
I don't know if it's the most Jewish of the Woody Allen films. Look, it's a Jewish family.
One ever goes to a Woody Allen movie and goes, too Jewy.
You know, Jenny Berlin, who played Charles Grodin's wife in the original Heartbreak Kid, which is a tremendous
It's Jeannie
movie.
Berlin, isn't it?
Is it Jenny? What did I say?
No, it's Jeannie.
What
yeah.
did I say? Jenny?
Jenny, yeah.
Well, she's the one that Charles Grodin dumps for Cybill Shepherd, you know?
Right. And whose daughter is that?
That is, she's Elaine May's daughter.
Right.
So she plays the older Jewish mother in this, and... I don't know. I don't think it, I don't know. I don't see this as really a Jewish movie. I mean, it, you know, I think there's a lot of great references when he's in Hollywood. Carell is very funny, you know, referencing all these old, like, I've got a deal in the making with the Joel McRae. You like Joel McRae, you know, and what
yeah,
do you
but
think?
That's not funny. That's actually one part I didn't like, was that he kept referencing these old people, but there were no jokes about them.
I just think mentioning the names of these, if you know Hollywood history, it's kind of funny.
I think that was the point to give you a sense of the time. It's just like we throw around names like George Clooney or you know, Jennifer Lopez or whoever the
and there's nothing funny about it.
Right. I think it just was to give it the period. But you know, it's interesting that you say it's the most Jewish because I saw this at Lincoln Square. I had to pay to go see it, and I saw it with like the intended audience. Okay, like nobody there was under 60, and they were all Jewish, and they got. Every single joke, they understood. Every Jewish, the Yiddish, I didn't understand. They were laughing. They got it. But it really played well. I really enjoyed it. I thought, to me, Jesse Eisenberg that's like he was born to do.
He looks like somebody out of the. I said that on the show for people who've never seen or heard this before.
I will agree with
an after show.
He was not very charming. He was very pushy.
Well, that scene with him and the hooker.
Yeah, that was a good scene. That was
there was a hooker in the movie.
But also, let me ask you guys: do you think that Woody Allen needs to stop meditating on May September romances, or do you think he's just working stuff out?
I think that's a pipe dream. I don't think he's ever going to do an age-appropriate romance comedy, and he doesn't have it in him.
I'm not going to give away the ending of this movie, but no. I love the ending of this movie because the ending of the movie, let's just say, reflects life. It's not like everything like is just wrapped up in a nice, tidy little bow. You know, you look at the ending and you say, like, yeah, okay.
It's
like,
a bittersweet ending.
You know, and I'm not going to say what that was. But there's a lot of good scenes in this. You know, you mentioned a scene just a moment ago. I like the scene where there's a neighbor that's playing his music too loud. And Jenny Berlin is being real disturbed by this neighbor, and the milquetoast husband keeps telling him to turn it down, and the guy
intellectual
is
milquetoast husband.
Right, and he's kind of like, no, you don't tell me what to do, and something happens there that's very funny. I like that scene. I think Eisenberg was very, very good. I thought
he looked the part, as we said on the
completely.
Show.
Look, I don't think that this is in the same league as, and I'll name some recent great Woody Allen movies, like Midnight in Paris or Blue Jasmine. But I certainly think it's as good. I certainly think it's a lot better than, let's say, Magic in the Moonlight or To Rome with Love or...
Well, I like To Rome with Love.
You know, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Well, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Well, my favorite, can I tell you my favorite line from the movie? He goes, you know, they say the unexamined life is not worth living. The examined life is no bargain.
That's my favorite was live every day as if it may be your last, and someday you'll be right.
You'll be right, right.
That's an old line. I mean, that's been around forever.
But that's what I liked about the movie. To me, I would call it kind of a laid-back Woody Allen. It's not super witty, but occasionally
he actually sounded really tired during the voiceover.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, he's starting to sound
80.
Like an 80-year-old guy.
He is. Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you know that Woody Allen voice from Annie Hall going, you know, there's an old joke, you know, there's another Jewish reference. Two Jews is in
his voice.
Right,
gone
his
down
voice is.
I need the eggs.
You're right. His low is down a few registers, and it's gravelly, but he's 80 years old.
It's less nasal.
But, you know, you recognized it immediately that it was Woody Allen doing the voiceover narration.
If this was his last film, would it be a fitting tribute?
You know, that's what somebody, you know, again, if you're joining us for the first time, this is an after show to a television show that we do here that airs locally in New York on New York One and nationally on Time Warner Cable called Talking Pictures. And somebody on the show today also mentioned, why would this be his last movie?
He's not 16. He's like 80-something.
I think this guy's going to make movies.
Until he drops.
Oh, absolutely.
I think him
and
Clint
he's making
Eastwood,
one now.
They're just going to keep making movies. A movie a
Amazon
year.
Amazon wants to give him $25 million to make his next one.
He's doing a TV series.
He's doing a TV series.
In his TV series.
Yeah.
Who's he going to play?
Yeah, what was that Totoro movie a couple of years ago?
I love that. Gigolo. Loved him. Loved the movie.
Yeah, that was with Sharon Stone and...
Yeah.
Sofia Vergara. Him
acting, I'm not so sure about.
I liked him. I thought he was perfectly cast.
Okay, this is a good film. Nicely captures the period. Nice little wonderful
not
touches.
Not just nicely, but
interesting
it's a beautiful-looking film.
Yes. And
it glows because it's about the golden era of Hollywood.
And intelligent, fair, if you're sick of watching all these comic book movies that are hitting the theater. And speaking about comic book movies, Bill did not see this, but Mike and I did. Star Trek Beyond?
Yes.
Hits theaters this week, and we both saw it. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell everybody what it's
about?
Well,
okay, I'll tell you what it's about. Basically, this is closer to Star Trek probably than the last two films, in that it feels almost like an episode of Star Trek where they've been out in space a long time and they're going to go on some kind of shore leave and something goes wrong. I don't want to give it away too much. But I like this movie. I thought that it's got the spirit of Star Trek. It's got the camaraderie of the old series. But at a number of points, it goes way, way over the top in terms of the action. That's like not, it seems almost out of place for a Star Trek film.
Okay. I disagree with you.
Really? Talk to me.
Except for the going over the top with the action, which I do agree with you.
I think it's heart's in the right place.
As a Star Trek fan.
I'm a
huge Star Trek fan also. My favorite is The Next Generation, but I like the original series a lot too. And I've seen like almost every episode of all this stuff. And the prime directive, to use a Star Trek term, is to really, it's science fiction. It's not Star Wars, which is more science fantasy. It's
science
fiction.
Completely science
fantasy. And it really challenges you intellectually. There's concepts in Star Trek episodes where, like, you, it's like they're almost like Twilight Zone episodes where you go like, oh, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And you really, are forced to think about things and concepts. And since J.J. Abrams took over the series, although I liked the first reboot, which was nice.
Decent.
This is kind of like an action film. I mean, first of all, it's directed by the guy who did the Fast and Furious
Justin
movies.
Lin.
Right. And it's an action movie. It's not a Star Trek movie. Yes, the characters are there. And yes, they are, they do pay homage
to Nimoy and the old cast.
To Nimoy and the original Kirk played by William Shatner. And
Bergoli, did you bring a pillow or do you have a deck of cards?
Believe it or not,
I'm dying to see it now. But I
think that, you know, when you get down to it, it's not the villain's not so good. You know,
it's better than the last movie's villain
and the first movie's villain. Just a lot of big budget action blow up stuff. And it could have been an Avengers movie or something.
Well, isn't that the problem with this genre? I mean, Bill and I haven't seen it, but just listening to you guys talk about it, it's like it seems like the formula now that no one wants to deviate from is to take established characters and put them in a big-budget blow-em-up movie, and you're almost interchangeable. There are clever moments that pay a nod to the people that the movies are about, but otherwise the scripts are completely interchangeable, and this sounds like another one.
Well, I think I agree with everything you said, Neil, and I don't think it completely works as a Star Trek film, but I felt that its heart at least was in the right place. I felt that it tried to be Star Trek. It tried to show their relationships. It's more...
Yes, it did try. I mean, the Nimoy,
tribute.
The tribute to Nimoy. Yes, I mean, it is Star Trek because they're on the Enterprise, and there's, you know, the characters. There's Kirk and Sulu and Spock and the late
I just wanted to ask about that. Is Anton Yelchin, like,
no,
is it sad to see him? And is does he have
really,
a little...
He doesn't have a really major part in the movie. I mean...
But Chekhov never did.
Does he have a nice moment that you go, oh, that's good, that was his last screen?
No. You know, it was co-written by Simon Pegg, who plays Scotty. I think
Scotty
that's
has
a really enhanced role as opposed to the principals being Spock and Kirk, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But I would think even Sulu. By the way, there's a whole talk about that Sulu comes out of the closet in this particular movie.
He does.
You know, and
that was being criticized.
Well,
it got criticized
by George Takei.
Yeah, and then he backpedaled on it, and then he said he's happy now. Yeah. Now,
well, I mean, it's
ooh,
really
like
subtle.
It.
It's just a nod.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even even catch it in the movie.
Yeah,
I read about it beforehand, and then I'm like, that never happened in the movie, so what did I miss, you know?
Well, I don't want to give it away, but there's a nod when we see Sulu. They all go on shore leave, and they all go meet up with their intended others, and we see something.
I guess I missed that part.
Yeah,
he walks into a bar that's not the one the others go into.
Yeah, he goes, oh, my.
Oh
no,
my.
It's very subtle, and I appreciate it was a nod to the fact that the actor who plays him is gay.
Where can a man get
like
a decent
it,
cosmopolitan in this town?
It's kind of silly. I can see why he backpedaled.
I found it to be an okay movie. You know, if you're a real hardcore Star Trek fan.
It was a lot
Trek
better
fan,
than Star Trek 2. Come on.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. Not Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan. The last Star
the
Trek.
The last
movie.
Star Trek.
Resurgence, was it called?
Regurgitation. Yeah. Star Trek Regurgitation.
Well, it's okay, but it's not great. And
it's not like I would watch a great episode
like The Inner Light or one of those Borg episodes where I would go like, oh, my God.
See, you're a next-gen fan. I'm original series.
Well, even original series, City on the Edge of Forever.
Right. Oh, boy, here we go. Smoke them if you got them.
Brilliant concept. Joan Collins was in that episode.
Yes, she was.
And it's a brilliant – it was written by Harlan Ellison.
Yes,
it's a brilliantly written episode.
Yes, nice.
And it's, I don't think you –
do you hear yourself when Joan Collins is the selling point?
Well, you know, I'll say this, Neil. You brought up a very good point.
It's no Tribbles.
The last thing I'll say – about Star Trek is that what Star Trek was, not so much a morality play, but it had something to say about the human experience. This pretty much has nothing to say.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to walk away going, wow, what a great
piece of writing.
We
weren't talking about anything, which is the disappointing.
I mean,
so is J.J. Abrams good at relaunching things, but then when it comes to... I know, but he's obviously the executive producer still, and he did, I think, an amazing job with the reboot two Star Treks ago. So... is he pretty much a set it up and let it roll kind of guy?
I think it's funny you say that because he did the same thing with Mission Impossible. I think he put that series back on track.
I agree. The third one.
Yeah, the third one. He gets what a series is about. He gets it, and then he finds a way to kind of update it. That's what he does.
I can't wait to see him take on Mr. Ed.
What about My Mother the Cop?
Can I tell you a horrible thing about Mr. Ed that you may not know?
Actually, they redid the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, that was
with Jim Varney. The late Jim Varney.
Do you know how they made Mr. Ed talk?
Yeah, they put peanut butter on
and piano wire.
Piano wire?
Yeah, on the horse?
Yep.
That's oh my god.
Yeah, this is way before the PETA or the SPC.
No, that's horrifying.
Are you sure about that?
Yep.
How did they get My Mother the Car to talk?
They just had Ann Southern do some voiceovers in a recording booth. All right, moving on. Star Trek, I think if you're not, just to wrap up on that, I think if you're not a fan of the series and you just like these Avengers, the action movie, you'll have fun.
It's Star Trek
if you're a real Star Trek fan and want to see something cerebral, I think you're barking up the
wrong tree. Would love to see J.J. Abrams do a Bond movie. It'll never happen, but
no,
that would
be
cool.
Can I say last thing about Star Trek? I think that if you're going to go this way, you're going to take Star Trek and try and take it to the next level, which is what I think they were trying to do. Take it to the next level, update it, whatnot. They should start giving it to like really visionary directors. Like let Timur Bebetkov, what's his name, who did Wanted and another movie. Let these directors who have huge visual styles take it over.
There's a new Star Trek television series that's coming on the air. And I think that Star Trek actually, for the most part, works better as a TV series because you can explore small concepts and you could have some episodes that
aren't
so great.
Will we ever see you again?
You could have some episodes that aren't so great and you could have some episodes that are like, wow, that's really...
That's spoken like a next-gen fan.
Because, even the original series, there's some good episodes. There's some really crappy
Spock's
episodes.
Brain.
You got a movie. I asked Rick Berman about this once, who, was the executive producer once Gene Roddenberry died of The Next Generation. And I said, why can't you just do a movie with a story like The Inner Light? He goes, well, you could do that story, but then you'd also have to have big set pieces because in a movie, people don't want – The Inner Light, Bill.
Yes,
is a very
please.
Small
enlighten the other three people who are still listening to this.
All right. I'm gonna knock it off. Anyway, when you have a movie, there's a lot of
I'll use the nerve pinch on Bill.
Anticipation by an audience that they're paying money and they want to see stuff blow up and big budget set pieces. And so you could do a story like that, but this story is kind of weak, And moving on. Okay. So there's a Miles Davis documentary that just came out. Tell us about it. It's called Miles Ahead.
Well, it's called Miles Ahead.
I'm sorry. It's not a documentary. It's a biopic with Don Cheadle, who co-wrote it.
Produced
directed it,
and stars.
Stars in it as Miles Davis and produced the movie. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, here's a couple of interesting things. This is something that Don Cheadle has wanted to do for a long time. And of any actor out there, he's clearly the favorite to play Miles Davis. He looks like him. He's got the similar build, similar skin color.
He plays the horn. He plays the horn.
But he talked about this in there's a featurette, if you go on demand or if you get the Blu-ray, where he talks about how over the last 20 years, he picked it up because he felt one day he could play this role, and he's been playing it. He's been playing the horn whenever he could
until
he got good. There are a lot of things about this movie that you might take for granted. In terms of how they
is
did
he actually playing? He's it's not actually
it's actually it's like, actually him playing.
It's not him just like pretending in your
no brain. No. He's credited at the if you he's watch playing. The credits. He's got a there's he's a playing. Sequence
now,
a horn sequence
we
where
don't
he plays.
Hear him playing. That's another horn player who is credited in the credits. Another horn player. You have to watch the featurette. You really should. But it is him playing. We do actually see him playing. He is actually interpreting.
But I'm not hearing him play.
But you're not hearing him play. Correct.
Well, the credits say he's horn sequence. Okay.
Yeah, he wrote some of the music for it. But I have to say, he really immerses himself in the film and in the role. And I think this works better than a lot of biopics that I've seen, over the last 15 years.
What it does is it focuses on probably the most unproductive period.
Yes,
it takes it,
where he stopped in the 70s.
Right, it's a few-day period of he didn't work for 5 years. He's not producing anything. And Ewan McGregor shows up.
From Rolling Stone.
Is a Rolling Stone journalist.
Well,
he's trying to sell an article to Rolling Stone. And he wants to know what Miles Davis is doing. Mm-hmm. And
why he's not doing anything.
Right, he's really not doing much of anything. And kind of as you said, Bill, it focuses on this tape that he made.
Well, he got money from Columbia to develop to work again. And they are paying him, but they've stopped paying him because they say, where's the master, Miles? Where's the master? And of course, you're told everything in a movie for a reason. On a tape deck in his, living room is a master tape, which he takes off, puts in a drawer, locks up, and then it becomes this kind of, it's a mad world like chase for this.
Yeah, you got some shady record exec that's trying to get it.
Yeah, which was kind of unfortunate. I mean,
but I like. Here's the thing,
Michael Stollmeyer.
To me, it's not a.
I thought he was channeling Joaquin Phoenix in that role.
It's not a seeing Joaquin. It's not a typical biopic like Walk the Line.
Right.
And I like that because this is about jazz or social music, as Miles Davis says. It's not. I don't like the term jazz. I like social music, but like a piece of jazz. You know, there's nothing straight up or conventional about jazz. So to do a straight up conventional biopic about Miles Davis kind of would have been disappointing.
I agree.
You know,
so
you always tell people, and I was going to mention it on the show today, and I'm jumping in now because if people, and I'm mixed on it. I think Cheadle's good. But you're a big champion of how you have to see things with subtitles. He's whispering this whole movie, and I put the subtitles on because I needed to hear it. Exactly what he was saying.
I need the subtitles.
I recommend it.
No, I don't. Do you use them for Clint Eastwood movies too?
No, but you know, I like the fact that it was like offbeat, like.
But he deserved. Miles Davis deserves a better. He deserves better than this sort of ragtag story of a Rolling Stone reporter and he being chased by and chasing the people that stole this tape. And it's kind of dopey in a way.
Well. It's a piece of, like, I think if Miles Davis was alive, he'd probably, like, say, yeah, like,
definitely.
Every piece of music is different. It's just like,
well,
you know.
He's crazy, but he's not.
He's crazy.
You know, Don Cheadle said that when he didn't want to just do a straight biopic, and he said that what he wanted to do was a heist movie. With Miles Davis.
That incident never happened, that probably.
No, it didn't. It didn't. But it's in the spirit. It would have happened if they had stolen this tape. That's what he would have done. And
you telling me this is tells me that Don Cheadle, who's been trying for whatever 20 years to get this made, kept getting told by Hollywood, "You got to put a story in here. You got to have some action in here." Now he goes off and makes Three Oceans movies, and he goes, "Ah, I need a heist in this movie." And now he's got Ewan McGregor as a Rolling Stone reporter who never really. None of this really happened, and that's annoying to me because Miles Davis couldn't drive a Ferrari in Los Angeles without getting pulled over all the time and asked for his license because he was profiled constantly. Right. There are just so many cool things that happen in this guy's life make a movie out of something that didn't happen.
But
is kind of annoying.
But in
to
a
me.
Way that it is like Neil says, it is like jazz because you take something that's established. Miles Davis was this. He was a recluse. He was a drug addict. He was not working. They tried to rip him off. Things happened to him, and then you kind of riff on it, and that's what he did.
You know, Bill,
improvise.
A lot of people don't. There's a lot of, if you listen to a piece of jazz music or a piece of Miles Davis music, you know, it's not going to be played on top 40 radio. There's somebody that's looking for a mainstream piece of music is going to say there's a lot missing from this. Where's the beat? Where's the this? Where's the that?
That's a really elegant excuse for a dopey plot in an otherwise good movie.
But
I'm telling
great
you, that's
flashbacks
all I'm saying.
In this. There's a scene in this where he goes
yes,
to the
because
Village
the flashbacks are before.
The Village Vanguard. And some white cop, which is so timely today, looks at him because he escorts
he off this white woman
into
who is obviously attracted to him,
who has obviously been stripping.
Yeah.
Well, stripping. I don't know. And then the cop, you know, locks him up for no good reason. You know, and I think there's a lot of interesting things in this movie. But okay, to each his own. You didn't like it. Mike liked it.
I liked
the performance. I think it's a missed opportunity.
You can't watch this movie and not want to go buy a Miles Davis record.
I'm never bored with what I never knew what Miles Davis, played by Don Cheadle, was going to do next in this particular movie. He was like nuts, and I definitely enjoyed that. Let's talk about. Let's talk about some food movies.
I have a list.
You have a list of some food movies?
Yes, I do.
Some people came prepared.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, first one, you had asked about this film, and I realized I did see it, Big Night.
Yep. I love Big Night. That's like, remember when he had kind of a little ragtag bunch of people, the way we're talking about Woody Allen, how he always worked with the same people.
Like an
ensemble. And, yeah. And
Stanley Tucci.
And Stanley Tucci was,
Stanley.
And he and Campbell Scott were kind of making movies together. And they were on the way to being a little like production company.
Like
and
the this Duplass is, Brothers.
Like the Duplass Brothers. And I think this is probably one of the best movies.
What
Big Night is awesome.
I love that scene in the end where he cooks his brother an egg.
Oh, yeah.
I can't cook an egg now. Thinking of that
that's
scene.
Great.
Like, I want to rewatch
Big
it.
Night. It's like, is it the 50s or the late 50s or the
early
60s?
No, I think
60s?
It's the early 60s.
Early 60s,
okay.
Yeah.
So, these people want to go to this Italian restaurant, and these guys are cooking better than anybody else, you know? And the country, America, just wasn't ready. Like, they go, oh, it's risotto, and it's this, and it's that. They go, well, where's the spaghetti and meatballs, and where's the red and white checkered tablecloth? Like, that's what, in the early 60s, people, like, I want an Italian meal.
Yeah.
They didn't understand. Like, it's a Brulio rice, and it's this, and it's that. Like, and they're cooking all this amazing Italian
authentic stuff Italian stuff
for to impress apparently this critic who's going to come and save the restaurant. But nobody's coming to this restaurant. They don't understand. The American public doesn't understand that, first of all, this food is 100 million times better than anything that's being served up in a traditional Italian restaurant at that particular time, which is like, oh, Italian food, what's that? Yeah, it's spaghetti.
But it's
meatball,
not a critic.
It's a veal parmesan.
Isn't it like Louis Prima? Isn't it like I've seen this movie a long, long time ago, but isn't it some musical guy that's supposed to have dinner there and they shut down the restaurant for him and then whether he shows
big
up or not?
Might be confusing it with the other movie on the list here, Ratatouille.
Yeah, well, yeah, I often get those two confused.
That's a great
brilliant.
It is a brilliant
film. That's a brilliant
film.
It's about food.
Yes,
and you know, it's a Pixar animated film, and this ain't no kid's film. I mean,
no.
You know, a kid could look at it and like it on a whole level, but there's a whole adult level in it.
A lot.
There's Peter O'Toole.
I was just going to say Peter O'Toole.
Of a critic at the end.
Perfect.
Playing something Ego or something.
Yes, yes, yes.
The name,
Anton
his name,
Ego.
His name, Ego.
Anton Ego.
He gives a rap on like what it's like to be a critic where, you know we're all critics. I mean, it's the most succinct, interesting monologue on what it's like to be a critic that I've ever heard. And even though he's referring to food and we do movies, it's just so, you know, about finding that small, obscure thing. And that's the joy of really bringing that to the light.
And it brings him back to his childhood when he bites it.
And Patton Oswalt does the voice of this rat who's the...
Great. What's interesting about the two movies you've mentioned is that it's at the time period before celebrity chefs came along. And we saw that. What's that movie that Mike Myers made about his agent pal that actually coined the term celebrity chef and made the guy that lived in Hawaii and he went down and visited him?
I saw it not too long ago, and I can't remember.
The idea of celebrity chefs has become such a category now on reality television that I was disappointed, for example, in the movie Burnt recently with Bradley Cooper. I love Sienna Miller, but it's an otherwise not great movie about a fallen chef who wants to get some Michelin stars. And it sounds, you know, it's high concept. It sounds great, but it's not.
His character was really hard to like.
He's a
bad boy
jerk.
A bad boy jerk, and I got a feeling most restaurants, real restaurants, would have not touched him. They would have said, no, this guy does not get hired.
You know what's a good movie is Chef.
Chef!
With
I was
John
just
going to put
that on my list.
Where he's like
great
chef
movie.
In this restaurant, and he...
He needs to get his mojo back.
He got a bad review. You know, the owner of the restaurant is making him cook these things that he doesn't
Dustin
really want
Hoffman.
To cook. Right.
Talking about great celebrity cameos, like John Favreau just called in every chit he had on
that. Did.
Right.
Yes, he
so
Robert Downey
he's
got
to cook this stuff that he doesn't want to do, and then the critic comes in and just like blasts how bad it is. So he says like basically screw this, and he goes out and starts making Cuban sandwiches in
on
a truck.
Food truck,
and,
yes.
And then that's
his
terrific
mojo.
Movie.
It's a terrific movie. John Leguizamo, great film.
Well, you know, we're talking about celebrity chefs, and I have to tell you that if you, it's the summertime, and I know this podcast is national, but if you're in the New York area, and if you're out in the Hamptons at all, this particular weekend, this Saturday, there's an event that. I've been going to for quite a number of years. Have you ever gone to it, Bill?
Yeah, I have. It's at Wolfer where, you know,
right.
I had some
it's
friends.
The James Beard Foundation's Chefs and Champagne event. And talk about celebrity chefs. They have like maybe 60 unbelievable chefs from the top restaurants in New York and in the Hamptons that give
like a battle of the bands.
Yeah, and they're making a little sample of one of their like top dishes and you walk around.
A morsel.
And you sample all this stuff, and it's just great. And it's, you know, you can go there, and, you know, you might say, okay, it's a pricey ticket. It's a couple of $100, but it's just unbelievable. I mean, as opposed
you might
to going...
You might say that. You would definitely say
well,
that.
But as opposed to going,
but to, going
to, like,
to La Bernardin
60 incredible
right.
restaurants and to taste what they consider to be one of their finest dishes. And it's not like they're giving you a whole entree. It's just a little samples. But you could have, if you love the dish, you could go back four or five times and have
Yes, I've seen you do that. I've seen them actually kick you out of those stalls.
But it's great. And the chefs are, you know, they're and it's not only considered the East End's premier culinary event, but funds raised at this event help support the James Beard Foundation, which has a wide variety of student scholarships and all kinds of other stuff. And
if you're not familiar with the James Beard Foundation, that is a group that takes people who are gay named James and pairs them up with someone as their beard, and then
such a funny guy. Well, anyway, I highly recommend that if you're out, it's this Saturday night.
Say the specific date, because this podcast obviously can be heard for the
Saturday, July 23rd, right. And you can go to their website at jamesbeard.org/chefsandchampagne. Or you can call 212-627-2308 for more information on that.
And you click on pictures of Neil actually eating at some of these stalls.
I'm telling you, I don't usually, but we're talking about all these food movies.
Sure.
And I'm telling you that, you're talking about, like, when I watched that chef movie with Jon Favreau, I've been searching ever since for one of those Cuban sandwiches.
A good Cuban
sandwich,
right?
Because those Cuban sandwiches just looked amazing. I'm going, like, where can I find a Cuban sandwich like this? So if you're watching these food movies and you want to just taste some great food, this is a worthwhile event. You'll be satisfied in terms of what you're eating, and it goes to a good cause.
All right, I got another film on my list: The Trip.
Oh, I love The Trip.
I love The Trip. With Steve Coogan. And
I'm not burying another Batman.
They're eating their way through.
Through Italy. Right.
Italy the second time.
And
it's The Trip to Italy.
Great
and
impressions.
England the first time.
I love it. The impressions of
the man in the box. The little man in the box is hilarious.
Yes, so many great things.
Cordry, is that his name?
Yes, Brian Cordry.
I have a food movie because I have done this whole broadcast now, and I haven't.
You're talking about
Rob done the creepy reference.
Rob Cordry.
Rob Cordry, right.
I haven't done the creepy reference yet, but.
Yeah, Rob Brydon is the co-star.
You guys remember
Tempopo?
Sure. It's classic.
Sex.
How about Like Water for Chocolate?
That's another classic. And here's the one that I thought just like, wow, when they put this on the food list, I went best food themed movies. Soylent Green. Like, who would have thought of that as a food themed movie?
You see Le Grand Bouffe, where everybody kills themselves with Marcello Mastroianni?
No.
And they all kill themselves by eating themselves to death?
Is the cook, the wife, the thief, and the lover on there?
No, but the 100-Foot Journey is on there.
Those are okay.
It was okay.
So should we end it, or should we talk about the Dark Horse before we leave, just switching
gears? I would like to talk about the Dark Horse, and all I'm going to say is that this is one of those films.
It's on demand.
On demand.
It's on DVD, just came out.
Right.
And go ahead. Tell
it stars Cliff Curtis as kind of a bipolar, not kind of, he's a bipolar former
New Zealand
former chess champion who takes on a ragtag bunch of kids and takes them to the Auckland finals.
You got to say that. How do you pronounce it, Mike?
Maori.
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 You see it?
Maori.
Yes, I saw it.
What do you think?
I liked him in it a lot, and the kids were really
actually. The guy is Cliff Curtis.
Yeah,
an
well, there are a lot of things I really like.
Cliff Curtis was like Pablo Escobar in Blow. He was like he's been the bad guy in so many movies.
So
this is kind of
Walking
his Robert
Dead,
De Niro.
The prequel series.
Yeah. He puts a little weight on. You're not really going to recognize him, but he doesn't play the
listen. This could have
handicapped or the challenged card to
easily. Can you think of some other?
It's
movies
not cliched.
Where. And there's so many of them in Hollywood where the teacher – there's docs like this too where the teacher comes in and takes an urban high school or a bunch of kids that
are – charter school documentary is famous in that.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah, but there's even some – there was a documentary. Wasn't it where somebody goes to like some dance finals or something like that or
– Oh, yeah.
Another one you're thinking of. Not ballroom.
But there's a lot of these, you know.
Right. But this
you know,
is a true
this
story.
This is a New Zealand
this
film.
This is based on a true story.
And it could easily – right, it is based on a true story. But this is not a conventional thing either, and I like that. I mean, the guy – yes, he gives these – again, how do you
– Maori.
Maori New Zealand
kids
who have no future really.
Right.
And they were just hanging out at this chess club, and they weren't even playing chess. And here's this chess savant who comes in and kind of brings them, like you said, Bill, to the – Auckland finals.
He's Boris Spastic.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things like you're saying
and,
that
and
I like
about
the
film. It's kind of more about there's a whole dynamic between this guy who's
and his brother.
And his brother. And the brother has a son. And the son, the brother
could
wants,
be a hoodlum, could walk
the
on
son
the
son to join this kind of like,
gang.
You know, this
gang.
Motorcycle rough.
It's a family
gang. And the other guy wants him to, you know, go and you know, play chess and have
it's
a more...
Sort of like they call me Mr. Tibbs in the hoods of Maori. But yeah, I really like this film for a lot of reasons because I did get a sense, like I really have not seen films about contemporary New Zealand. Like, you know, what are the Maori people like? What are their issues?
Right.
What are they dealing with? I thought that was great. Against the backdrop of something like this, I thought it really, really worked.
The Dark Horse. Seek it out.
Watch it with subtitles because it's very hard to understand without the subtitles. That's my advice.
Yeah, they mumble a lot.
And as Bill said, there's another movie called Dark Horse. That's not this, not to be confused. This is The Dark Horse. Dark Horse is a movie about the group of people in Ireland.
Not a bad documentary.
It was a documentary about a group of people in Ireland who buy a racehorse. And that's not this. This is about this is the chess movie called
You want the chess
Horse.
One.
Next week, we're going to talk about Jason Bourne. Matt Damon returns to the series that he...
I really want to see this. We haven't yet. We're getting to an all-media
Monday night.
And except for a cliched-looking drive through Las Vegas in the trailer, I think it's going to be... I hope it's going to be great.
Well, it's Paul Greengrass.
Paul Greengrass, who didn't originate. Doug Liman did. He did the second and I think the fourth.
Second and the third.
Do you know his name?
Paul Greengrass.
No, I'm saying that's the ad.
It's the ad.
You know his name?
Yeah.
Which is kind of clever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? All right, so that's it.
And it's not Jason Bourne. Remember? That's his real name is something else, which
Matt
totally...
Damon. It's Matt Damon.
That's true. Well, so Matt Damon returns. So we'll talk about that next week and a whole bunch of other things. So for Bill Bregoli.
Yes.
Bill McCuddy.
Here I am.
Thank you, Mike Sargent, for joining us.
Thank you.
And me, Neil Rosen. Thanks for sitting around talking movies. Where Bill McCuddy, what do we do on this show?
We watch the bad movies so you don't have to.
That's right.
In this case, it was Miles Davis movies.
No, it wasn't.
It's not. It was good.
No, it wasn't. It was good. All right. Anyway, thanks for sitting around. We'll sit around and talk about movies with you next week.